Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. A year ago, Charlotte Spectrum Center hosted a neutral site women's basketball game between the University of Iowa and Virginia Tech. These kinds of standalone events are common in the men's game. Take two high-profile teams, put them in an NBA arena, have ESPN show the game, and people will buy tickets and watch on TV. Women's basketball, not so much. When that Iowa-Virginia Tech game drew a near-capacity crowd of 15,000 fans, and each school went home with a $150,000 check, eyebrows were raised. That a major bank, Ally Financial, paid for title sponsorship added to the sense of yet another shift in the overnight rise of women's sports. Overnight, that is, if you think the passage of Title IX in 1972 was yesterday. The main attraction for that 2023 game in Charlotte was Iowa's Caitlin Clark, who soon became the all-time NCAA scoring leader while taking her team to consecutive national championship games. If you're wondering whatever happened to Caitlin Clark, she just won the WNBA's Rookie of the Year award. As for Charlotte and women's basketball, the Ally tip-off served up an encore in 2024 that sold even more tickets and without Clark's star power. The main attraction this time? The defending national champion South Carolina Gamecocks, coached by Dawn Staley, who can make a strong claim as the best in the business. 25 years ago, Staley spent the summer playing in front of sparse crowds for the Charlotte Sting in the WNBA. The Sting folded a few years later, doomed by a lack of interest and league-wide business struggles. That same WNBA now commands $100 million and up for expansion teams. Caitlin Clark and Dawn Staley are just two examples of soaring interest in women's sports. In 2024, for the first time, more people watched the women's Final Four championship game than the men's. And finally, the all-too-male world of mainstream sports is catching on. Few people understand the disparities and biases that women and their sports leagues and teams have had to overcome better than Jane McManus. She is a journalist, a professor, and most recently, the editor of the year's best sports writing, 2024. Jane McManus, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
I'm very glad to be here, Eric. Thanks for having me.
So my introduction obviously focused on women's sports because one of the things you did with this year's version is you ramped up the number of stories written by female journalists and the number of stories about female athletes and coaches. And you put Caitlin Clark on the cover. And the best part is none of this is forced or out of place. So how did you do what you did?
You know, I think every single person who's ever edited this incredible volume, they bring to it their own interests. They bring to it the things that they like to see, the stories they like to read. I asked a couple of the former editors what they looked for, what I should look for when I'm putting this together. So, you know, reading hundreds of stories, both submitted by people who are reading everything in our business or keeping their, you know, their eye on a corner of the business, somebody who likes baseball writing, for example, or, you know, from a certain region, West Coast, everything like that. And they said, basically, you know, pick the stories that when you wake up the next day, you're still thinking about them. And I think that's kind of a good way to look at it. You could have 100 different people pick 100 different stories for this particular volume. But these are the stories that I picked. And the reason for that, you're right, is I have an eye for that kind of storytelling. I like stories about women as athletes. I think we're also at a period of time now where there are more stories about women as athletes being written. And they're not the one-offs, the one-off stories. Here's a great woman in sports, you go girl. I mean, you know, the kind of writing that I like about women in sports is the same kind of writing that I like about men in sports. It's multi-layered. It's probing. It's not saccharine. It's not hero worship. It's presenting people as full and complex. And yeah, I do like that kind of storytelling. And I think there was probably more of it out there this year and in recent years because women's sports are on the rise again. And yeah, those are the stories I liked that when I woke up the next day, I was thinking about them.
And you helped with the previous edition, right? You were kind of an advisor on that one. And is that really what gave you the urge to give this a try? Steering the ship, so to speak?
Sure. So Richard Deitch, who is at The Athletic and does the sports media column for The Athletic, he was the guest editor of the year before. And Richard Deitch and I go way back. We both had a professor at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism where we both went. And when that professor retired, he asked us to take over the class. So we taught the sports journalism class at Columbia for a couple of years. And you know, we've been friends forever. And so when he asked me to be on his advisory council, I was obviously thrilled, right? Because this is like such a legendary volume and that it's, you know, that of course I wanted to do it. And also, you know, we read a lot and I, you know, I like bringing him stories and being a bit contrarian about things and bouncing things off him. So when they approached me and asked if I would be willing to do it, and, you know, both Richard Deitch is on my advisory council. And so Sandy Padway, the professor that we had at Columbia, who is, you know, now in his late 70s. And, you know, and I wanted them both to be able to be on that, and Kavitha Davidson and J.A. Adonde as well. So, you know, getting again those storytelling, the stories from all of these different people who read and kind of having them bring things to me and being able to go back and forth. It is a collaborative effort every single year, not just this year.
And obviously you had that experience and then you took over editing it this year. Prior to that, were you a fan of the series? Did you pay close attention to it when it started in the 1990s and up to now?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know if you know much about sports journalists, but boy, do we love awards. Praise, prizes, honors.
That's a human condition, I think.
Yeah, exactly. We sure do live for that. So yeah, of course I read it because, and you know, people would give it to me for Christmas. Like once you express an interest in being a sports writer, I think this book is something that people think about for you. And yeah, you want to be in there in some way. And also just, you know, reading to see what the best, you know, writing was each year. It's kind of the, you know, it's a bit of a roadmap, right? It's like, here's how you tell a good story. Maybe you should think about writing this way a little bit more, use some more adjectives, interview one extra person, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, these are the stories that are kind of going to show you how to do that. And I think that for young writers in particular, being able to have a volume like this is really important. It's a guide. And particularly in this day and age, because the way we read about sports, the way we understand sports, those media are all changing and people are getting their information in different ways now, shorter, choppier, more video, that kind of thing. And you can get it from a million different sources. There isn't, you know, there are exceptions to this and we will be talking about them, I'm sure, in this hour, but you know, people don't all read the same thing. They're not like, oh, we all watched the same show. We all read the same story in the newspaper. You're getting it from myriad sources. So for everybody to be able to come together and read these stories, it's more important than ever, I think, in a lot of ways. Just, yes, it's more of a niche. Fewer people are writing like this, but, and yet, you know, there's something to the format, which is long, requires a certain amount of focus, requires you to really sit down with something. I think it asks more of you and your brain and your engagement and your focus. And I think it's important for particularly young writers, aspirational writers, readers of sport to have that as an example and as something that they have access to.
That's the voice of Jane McManus. She is the editor of the year's best sports writing 2024, which has recently come out, a collection of all the best sports writing, just like the title says. As you know, Jane, one of the biggest hurdles in women's sports is the media itself and media coverage. I mentioned Ally Financial earlier. That company is taking an interesting approach in sports advertising and sponsorship. They back women's leagues, including the NWSL, But the bank has also put language into its contracts with ESPN and the ACC, steering money specifically to women's games and to telling women's stories. What do you think about that, and would you like to see more of that?
I mean, I think it's a great approach. That has been really successful for Ally for a number of different reasons. And they didn't do it to draw attention, but they are getting attention to their company, to their bank, because of this initiative. Every time their name is mentioned in conjunction with equity, that looks good for that company. They're getting, I think, more than they're getting more shine from that than the amount of money that they're spending. You can't pay for that kind of reporting around what you're doing as a company. So I think that there's that's a very big part of it. And yeah, I would of course like to see more of that. But you know, it's a tricky environment right now. The media, there was a study that was started in the late 80s by Michael Messner and Cheryl Cookie. They did some research on how much of your average sports center was content about women's sports. And the number back in when they started doing it back in the late 80s was 4 to 5% of your average sports center was about women's sports. Didn't matter if it was a World Cup, didn't matter if it was, you know, championships, anything. That was the amount. And they continued that study until 2019 when the pandemic hit. And the number at that time, 4 to 5%. There had been so little progress because, you know, the media is very entrenched in the way that it tells stories. So, you know, unfortunately, the Ally Bank, unless they're sponsoring, you know, a paper, an individual outlet and the coverage, I simply haven't seen, you know, it could be, you know, much more effective with a company like ESPN because they have the resources and they can kind of, you know, steer things that way, sponsored content, that kind of thing. But I just think for the overall media environment that might not have as much of an effect. There needs to be real systemic change here.
And I mentioned a couple of times, and you know this better than I do, that the popularity of women's sports is growing quickly. And that means people are starting to make money or they're making more money. And that's what generates media coverage and attention. People tend to be motivated by that as much as anything, if not more than anything. So from that aspect, do you have hope that maybe if people don't do the right thing always, they might do the pragmatic thing?
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I mean, there have been a number of, you know, part of the issue is that there hasn't been a lot of number making around women's sports. Like, what is the total addressable market? Like, who are the fans of women's sports? It's only been in the last 4 years or so that companies have been even starting to do that. Wasserman Collective, Sports Innovation Labs are two of the main ones. And they've come up with some really interesting numbers. But the projected market for women's sports next year is $1 to $2 billion. And that's a lot more than has been projected in the past. And the trajectory, you know, you look at where is the graph heading? Is it going up or is it going down? And it's going way up. That's a pretty steep curve up. So, you know, the investments in women's sports that are happening now, the potential for payoff for those investors is really high.
We need to take a time out. We'll have more with Jane McManus, and we'll discuss more of the best sports writing of 2024 coming up next right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Jane McManus. She is the editor of the Year's Best Sports Writing 2024, a collection of stories about players, coaches, and in many cases, grappling with challenges such as addiction, abuse, and mental health. Jane, we were talking a little bit about the numbers on media and media coverage, and you mentioned the marketing firm Wasserman. They, as I'm sure you know, recently did a study that determined, I think, something like 15% of sports coverage is now dedicated to women's sports. Still a long way to go, but up from 4%, as you said. So do you think those numbers are correct or in the right ballpark? And if so, what are the next steps?
Those numbers are definitely correct. One of the numbers that was aggregated in that 15% is streaming for women's games, which is obviously something that Cookie and Messner couldn't put into their 1989 version of this, because that simply didn't exist. So, the fact that there are options for streaming is one thing. That doesn't necessarily mean people are consuming it, though, necessarily. So I think that 15% may be a little high. And yet at the same time, I think it's definitely higher than the 5%. When I was at ESPN, working at ESPNW and covering the NFL in 2015, there were a number of times that we tried to start a show around women's sports content, kind of a half hour show that could be devoted to what happened in women's sports that week. It never got off the ground. And to this day, ESPN hasn't had a show that regularly looks at women's sports necessarily, or a women's sports on a regular basis. And they've owned, the rights for the WNBA and for the women's Final Four now for decades. So, it's something where the opportunity is certainly there, but there have been a lot of reasons why it hasn't necessarily happened. But I do think that they are integrating more women's sports content onto shows like, First Take, for example, famously, and SportsCenter.
Now, this is anecdotal, not scientific in any way. I'm a middle-aged white male, part of the problem a lot of the times. It feels to me like we have progressed beyond, you should pay attention to women's sports because it's the right thing to do, or because we need a diverse population, all those things, to, hey, Caitlin Clark is really fun to watch, Simone Biles is incredible, so on and so forth. But I wonder, is this a case of self-delusion on my part? Or, we're generalizing, obviously. But what do you hear and see from the executives who are running leagues and networks who, let's face it, still tend to be predominantly male?
Well, yes. I mean, nobody has to like women's sports. Like, this is the beauty of it. Like, I don't have to like UFC. I don't have to like the NFL. I don't have to like or watch anything that I don't like. And the same is true about women's sports. The problem has been that, and I make this analogy, like if you don't like broccoli, you don't have to order it at a restaurant, but you also don't have to get up out of your seat and go into the kitchen and yell at the chef for making broccoli for somebody else, or demand that it be taken off the menu. Like, just don't eat the broccoli. No one cares. That is the way that I look at this. But I think that, the way that it's been treated by, the problem is that the decision makers who don't like women's sports are gonna, they have the ability to enforce that and decision onto other people and onto the lineups at different, broadcasters in another ways to kind of their reluctance ends up meaning that those kinds of sports are not as available to watch. So, and in that has been for a lot of cultural reasons, and also a lot of reasons around advertising, like who is advertising on these different shows. And that's why I think it's important to say, and which is now being done, around Wasserman, is who is the fan of the WNBA? Who is the fan of the NWSL? How are they consuming this sport? How are we making it available to them? Is there potentially a higher market there? And I think one way to look at it is that you've probably seen these stories, but in 2019, the U.S. Women's National Team was going for the World Cup, ended up winning the World Cup in France that year. But the jerseys that Nike made sold out right away. And it turns out that they made an extraordinarily low number of jerseys because they weren't expecting them to sell out. Now, once those sold out, they had to reorder that entire, slate of line of clothing to be to be manufactured all over again, which meant that it wasn't then available again until after the World Cup. So what happens is that you can't then use the number of jerseys that are sold to advocate for more coverage or more attention to, because the number that was sold was the low number that was made at the beginning. And these are the kinds of decisions that are being made, you know, at the whoever it was who said, oh, nobody cares, nobody's going to want to buy these jerseys, we're only going to make a certain number of them. That person ends up proving his or her assumption that these things can't be sold, because the number they get sold, nobody tells the story about all the, you know, jerseys that weren't sold. The number they get sold is the number that got sold. So, right. You know, again, these decisions that are made in assuming that there's no marketplace end up enforcing that there's no marketplace.
I'm curious whether you have looked at or heard others look at if women's sports gain, do men's sports lose? You know, is there any, I guess, paranoia, you know, any over concern from the leagues that are dominant that the growth of women's sports somehow takes away from them? And only I don't even know if that matters.
Only in a sociological sense, certainly not in an economic sense. Does the NFL get concerned if more people are watching NASCAR? Of course not.
Right.
I mean, right. So again, like if you just make that comparison in any other way, the reason that people get concerned is because they have, you know, they have different assumptions about gender roles and who should be doing what and who values women in that space. It's not going to be everybody, because not everybody values women in a powerful role outside the home, earning money, you know, doing, being aggressive, like all, but that's a sociological concern. That's not an economic concern. So again, I think, you know, women and women's sports have been tied down to these kind of unspoken notions about what women should actually be doing. And it's very difficult to disentangle that in our culture. I think some of that is starting to happen. You know, people see the how, you know, what it's like for their girls when they play sports, just like when they see what it's like for their boys when they play sport. And those, you know, those friendships, those skills, the discipline, the self-discipline that's learned. I mean, that's great. No matter, you know, your gender, it's not tied to gender. So, you know, teaching girls to have autonomy and to be powerful and to trust their bodies and all of these things, I mean, that's just as good for your daughters as it is for your sons. And I think people are starting to understand and kind of disentangle these notions of, gender from sports.
That's the voice of Jane McManus. She is the editor of the new collection, The Year's Best Sports Writing 2024. Let's talk about some of the stories that you selected for this collection, which it's great. It's about 25 stories, I think. And I want to start at the start. The first story in the collection is about the great tennis players Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova and their 50-year rivalry, both on the court for a lot of those years and friendship off the court for pretty much all of that time. The story was written by Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post, and she details how the two of them helped each other through illness. Here's a little portion of what she writes. Quote, "You want to meet an opponent who draws you nearer in mutual understanding? Try having cancer at the same time," end quote. What drew you to this story?
Oh my gosh. Sally Jenkins is just, she's bar none, just one of the best writers that in the English language, I think, today. And we're lucky to have her writing in sports. You know, she loves it. She has she's just got a deft touch with it. It's, you know, she's really able to get to the heart of something. And yeah, and that's what I love about that story is that she's in many ways an important participant in it, because that story is only possible because of the trust that she has established over decades with Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert. And, you know, we kind of sometimes take for granted that it takes that kind of knowledge and intimacy and trust in order to write a story like this, but you can absolutely see it on the page there. Also, you know, the Washington Post is they have a strong sports department. They have great editors there and they have resources. They're one of the few papers that still is able to resource that kind of sports writing. And they told her, take the time you need, you know, go where you need to go to be able to tell this story right. They assigned a videographer to it. If you, you should definitely read it in the year's best sports writing this year. But if you want to go online as well, there's a fabulous video component to it as well. And again, that all kind of comes together. You have an institution like the Washington Post saying, we care about this, and allowing for that story to be written in the way that it needed to be. It is a long story by sports, you know, standards, but it's absolutely worth every single word. And, you know, it speaks very well for that institution and what they're able to put together. And, you know, she hit it out of the park. And that story, if you get sometimes a little cynical about people reading long form, that story led the site, the Washington Post website, because it was so good. It demanded its readers read it. I think that says a lot, that a story like that, well-written, well-told, can still draw a crowd.
And this is obviously a general interest conversation. We're not delivering a journalism seminar here, but you are both a journalist and a professor. And I am curious, you mentioned the trust, the time. A story like that, when you read this story and the level of detail about gifts they've given each other, about difficult conversations they've had when one of them was going through treatment or another one was going through a difficult personal relationship, those are not the kinds of things that people get through one interview or two interviews or probably even 5 or 10 interviews. And certainly not even in the course of a month or 2 or 3 months. So I just wonder how much you present that as an example to students and other journalists of what it takes to do work like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just to students and other journalists, but to editors and to people who are starting new media outlets and think it can be done just with young talent and a couple of cameras, like a couple of iPhones, sending it out there. I mean, and that's, you know, there are great young writers who can really produce high quality content. But again, this is somebody's the livelihood. They're at the top of their game after decades in the business. So I think that speaks volume. It is. It's a beacon of a story. And Sally Jenkins, you know, give her all the accolades because she hit it out of the park. Absolutely.
In your introduction, you write, quote, these tales are all woven around sports, but you don't have to care for sports to find yourself transfixed. League stats are irrelevant, end quote. To that point, how many of the figures or sports in these stories were from realms that maybe you don't typically follow or have a lot of interest in?
Yeah, 100%. So, you know, talk about the planning for this. When Richard Deitch was kind of going through some of the things that he was going to include in his volume, I think one of his favorite stories, and I don't want to speak out of turn, was a story about skipping stones and a competition on stone skipping. It was a brilliant story. And there were definitely, and I don't know anything about skipping stones competitively. I'm not a big into the history of that. It's not something I watch on the regular. But at the same time, I was absolutely, you know, just captivated by the people that were being discussed in this story. And the same thing is true in this. I don't follow surfing. There's a tremendous story about surfing in this that you should absolutely, about a guy who was a lifeguard in Maui when one of these competitions that's based not on time of year, but on conditions of surf. Just, we're going to have the Big Eddie this year, right here, right now. And he was lifeguarding that day. And I'm not going to give it away because it is such a good ending. But it is, you will want to read this and find out about this lifeguard, with his young wife and his young kids, and what it meant for him to be able to compete on that day. And those are the kinds of stories. I really do think, like, great sports writing is great writing. There's a great tradition of sports writing. You know, Hemingway was a sports writer. Kerouac got his start, you know, writing sports. There's some modern writers, you know, Samantha Power, before she ended up being U.S. ambassador, she started out as a sports writer. You know, like there, it's, it really is a good training ground. And one of the great things about it is it lets people write, you know, it just lets you write and, set a scene. You have to set a scene. You, what, yeah, I remember when I was coming up, I was doing a sidebar at the Mets one day with a writer named Kit Steer, and he looked at me and he was like, Jane, you know, you should always put, the temperature in your stories. He's like, you know, people weren't at the ballpark that day. Was it hot? Was it windy? You know, was it cloudy? What was it like to be there? And, you know, to me, like, I took that to heart and, you know, often would try to figure out, like, how do I tell somebody what it felt like to be in the stands, what it felt like? And that's what great sports writing did, particularly in the days before television. It was the photograph. The writing was the photograph. The writing was the video. The writing was, how did the ball, you know, where in the stands did that ball land? And you had to be able to do it all. So there's this great tradition of sports writing because it allows people to write. And I think, you know, that's the spirit in which this anthology was started. And I think you can, you know, there are so many stories in here that will put you in the, they'll put you on the beach as that surfing competition was taking place.
By the way, on that surfing story, and I'm not going to give anything away either, but it is the equivalent to me of someone being a locker room attendant at a football stadium and then going out and playing quarterback in between shifts. Fair?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. You know, whenever my husband's a huge tennis fan, and whenever he goes and he watches tennis, he is fully kitted out. Like, you could literally, like, Rafael Nadal, you know, Nadal gets injured. I know Nadal just retired, but, you know, gets injured, like, you know, put my husband in. He's dressed for it. He's got the shoes, you know, like, absolutely. And that's like, you know, that's as if my husband got to go in you know, take over for Djokovic, you know, at the US Open final or something. It's pretty crazy.
It is fantastic. And you have to read it to find out how the cliffhanger ends. We're going to take one more break, and then we're going to come back with Jane McManus, and she's going to tell us more about the best sports writing of the year for 2024 and a little bit more about women's sports and their rise in the sports business. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and our guest today is Jane McManus. She is the editor of the year's Best Sports Writing 2024, a collection of stories about players, coaches, and the realms they work in. And Jane, I read that bit from your introduction earlier, and you mentioned league stats are irrelevant for enjoying these stories. But of course, stats aren't entirely irrelevant in sports. And so to that end, by my calculations, hazardous at best, 10 of the writers of the 25 stories in this collection are women, and 11 of the 25 stories focus on female athletes and coaches. And I'm wondering, what kind of balance, if any, did you have in mind? Obviously, you want the best work. That's where you start. But how much, if at all, did you think about how those things might shake out?
Wow. I guess if I wanted true balance, I'd have needed some more women writers and a few more stories about women in there.
You were pretty close, though. You did a pretty good job.
I will say, I didn't actually, you know what? I didn't count that. So this is, you're breaking news here on this show for me. So nice job with that. You know, I just picked the stories that I was drawn to, and, I read everything, and I did have a lot of people send me things. And I am drawn to stories about women. I'm drawn to stories about relationships. That's the other thing that I noticed is a bit of a theme here. There are a couple of stories about parents and children, in some capacity, who have ties to sports and, you know, were pro athletes or, in some capacity like that. So I find that, like, you know, to be revealing. And again, because it's the writing and the storytelling. And to me, that's really important. I think the other thing is, I, unlike I don't like the kind of storytelling that is just here is an athlete, and my goodness, is he the greatest? And he says these great things, and he's other people say these great things about him, and isn't he just amazing? I find that very flat, and so like stories like that are just, you know. And I know that some people like storytelling like that a little bit more. I kind of tend to. I was interested in relationships. I was also interested in storytellings where writers were taking risks and talking about things that are difficult to talk about. So for example, Jarrett Bell, he is a writer for USA Today, a columnist, and he did a column on Andy Reid at his second straight Super Bowl after the first Super Bowl, his son had killed a young child or severely injured a girl in a DUI accident. And that to me, you know, nobody wants to ask Andy Reid about that. It's a hard question. But Jarrett Bell did it, and he wrote a column. It's an important thing to ask about because, you know, here he was back on the same stage in a way. And his son had been an assistant coach for that Chiefs team. So it was relevant. And I think that's, you know, it's important. And Candace Buckner from the Washington Post, and there's quite a bit from the Washington Post in here. I think they do a good job.
Five.
I really do.
You had five if you're counting. Yes.
I did know that one because I was like, ooh. And, you know, some people I think try to spread it out a little bit more. But I just think that the way they resource those stories. And the other thing is the five stories from the Post are all very different. You know, one is about Chris Nowinski, who started the Concussion Legacy Foundation. And he played for Harvard, and his teammates, there's a real schism on that team on this particular issue. And, you know, that's something that I see in football from the players that I covered for sure. Like that to me is a microcosm of a larger issue and a larger discussion that's taking place. And that story was just so well written. Kent Babb did that. It was so well written. He absolutely reported the heck out of it. And it was clear that those players had also opened up to him and really trusted him. So I just think like they're doing really, really good storytelling. And I almost felt it was almost the opposite of that. It was like, why would I penalize the three stories at the Washington Post that aren't quite as good as the other two stories by not having them in here when they really are better than a lot of the other work that's being done elsewhere? Why would I, cap the story on female, the stories I have on female athletes or written by female writers so that I don't seem, you know, too, so that there's not quote unquote too much of that in here. And so I just kind of unapologetically figured, you know, I liked these stories from the Washington Post. I like these stories these women in sports wrote. And I like these stories about these female athletes and just kind of let it roll. And then maybe that's like why I'm a little bit different, because maybe somebody else would have thought, ooh, I don't want to be accused of being too this or that. But I think you just have to, you know, and next year you'll have a different editor who may, you know, maybe all of the stories are going to be about one thing or another thing. Who knows? But, you know, all I could do is really reward the work that I found really deserving of being in this volume and that I thought readers would really enjoy reading.
I want to get your reaction to this. And maybe this is me overanalyzing, thinking too much about statistics, but I dug out my copy of The Best American Sports Writing of the Century, which was published in 1999. One of my favorite books, by the way, edited by David Halberstam and Dick Schaap. It includes 59 stories. Two were written by women, and the only one that focuses on a female protagonist is George Plimpton's reminiscence of taking his 9-year-old daughter to the Harvard-Yale football game. When I say that to you, is any of it a surprise, and how do you measure progress from that? And I'm going into this premise of the question, acknowledging that the bar is painfully low.
I mean, it's absolutely, when you say that Hemingway is the great, you know, exemplar of sports writing that was held up as the standard for the greater part of the 20th century. I think, you know, people are looking for a type. They recognize a type of story and that is worth that kind of accolade. And I do think that it was this, you know, idea. I don't want to sound too much like a sociology professor, which, you know, I am at the moment. But, you know, there are hegemonic attitudes in sports. And that, you know, usually it's the idea of masculinity. Sports are something where we, you know, many a sports broadcast is a love song to masculinity in a lot of ways. And that's fine. And that's the way it has been. But I want to expand the definition of that to include people, you know, like me. I was a little kid growing up who loved sports and just wanted to play sports. And they used to call us tomboys, you know, and I would play in the neighborhood with all the, you know, with all the boys. And, you know, and then when I was, you know, playing, you know, basketball as a, you know, pick up basketball and basketball intramurals, you know, having like a friend's mom ask me if I was a lesbian because I liked sports and, you know, all of these different things. And I always felt, you know, and I thought when I became a sports writer that people would see that I wanted to be like the Knicks beat writer for the New York Times. And that I was, you know, because of my own love for basketball and my own, you know, love of play and, you know, following sports like I did, and that people would see that I was a native to this space as well. But that's not the message that you get, you know, necessarily as a woman in sports. And I, you know, I know this because I hear it from my students who still have to deal with the same stuff. And I just want there to be room for everybody at the table. So,
by the way, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you go first.
I was just going to say, and I'm not trying to, absolutely. That's why I asked you the question. And at the same time, the work in there is great. But looking back at it, which I read it 25 years ago when it came out, I was shocked. I mean, I just assumed Billie Jean King was in there, Wilma Rudolph was in there, you know, go on and on and on. And no, just not there.
Yeah, well, you know, some of the, and I saw this, I experienced this in my career. If I wanted to go far in my career, I was better off covering the NFL than joining ESPNW when they asked. But I joined ESPNW because I care about women's sports and I like them. Now, it's not why I got into sports writing. I got into sports writing because I wanted to, as I said, cover the Knicks. But yeah, I think that, you know, that is something that, you know, the best, quote unquote, best sports writer, the most gifted writers from the generations previous, when they were going to write, they were assigned to cover the most important sports stories. And those were always about men. And so, you know, just generally. And there are exceptions, of course, but most generally, those stories were about men. And so the storytelling of the time that would reach the bar, because it was assigned to the writers who had that in them, had the ability, had the voice, you know, that's why you kind of get this self-confirmatory anthology like that. Yes, it's disappointing to me. And it was disappointing to me when I started in sports, for sure. But I do think it's changing. I'm not, you know, when I put this anthology together, those stories written by women were not a reach to put in there, you know?
Oh, no, it's a great collection. At no point did I think, I mean, I was counting and doing those things because I realized you're doing something different. You're broadening the conversation. But at no point when I was reading this did I think, oh, why is this in here? It's all great work.
And anybody would have picked that Sally Jenkins story about Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert. And I think it was, you know, it's the consensus leader in the pack for the writing from that year.
And to me, my favorite story I want to ask you about now, my favorite story in the collection, and it's a story that I think kind of brings all of these themes together, which is women being represented in sports, women being able to tell the story, the decisions women have to make because of all the contradictions and biases and things that they face. And that story is called The Catch. It's by a writer named Emily Sohn. I hope I'm saying her name right. And it's about a woman named Virginia Kraft. She was Sports Illustrated's big game hunting and fishing correspondent for 26 years. She hunted with kings and celebrities all over the world. She proved to be a ruthless hunter herself. The reporter describes Kraft in Brazil in 1965. And she's seeking a glimpse of a jaguar. And she writes, quote, "But after finally setting her gaze on the animal that had eluded her for nearly a decade, she raised her rifle, took aim, and shot it dead," end quote. And this profile grapples with the trailblazing and the contradictions, as I said. Tell me how you found this one and if you see similar themes that I'm picking up on in this story.
I am so glad that you have focused in on this, because I had the same thought when I was reading it. And, you know, my professor, Sandy Padway, knew Virginia Kraft. So I was able to go back and ask him about her as well. But this story is just a gem, and it's long and it's in depth, but it kind of gives you a glimpse of that period of time, you know, that Halberstam and Schaap were choosing those stories from. And, you know, she was the first woman who was a full-time writer at Sports Illustrated, back when Sports Illustrated was the giant in the industry. And she was going against the grain in every possible way that you could. What I love about the story too, is she goes in and she calculates how much sports writers were getting paid and how much she was getting paid writing in, you know, I guess for a women's magazine. And even by asking for less than the sports writers were getting, she was doubling her own salary, which just gives you also, it's this idea of value. What do we value women do, you know, the jobs that women do and the jobs that men do. And she was finding that she still, even by taking half the salary, was coming out ahead. And she seemed to have a genuine interest also in what she was doing. And it was all of the glamour of, you know, that what you would think of someone, you know, traveling the world and covering something that we don't really consider sports now, and which is pretty problematic also from a modern point of view. Mm-hmm. So all of these things, I think, make, again, it's not a good, bad story. It's not it's a complicated story. And also, it also seems as though she was not necessarily pulling up other women behind her. She felt like she had her place, and she did what she did, but that she didn't necessarily think this was another job that other women would excel at. And so, you know, again, like we're not looking at superheroes here. This is not a hagiography. Mm-hmm. We are looking at a complicated woman who was doing something very against the grain socially at the time that she was doing it. I found it fascinating from beginning to end. I could read that story over and over again. It's another one where there's some great photographs if mm-hmm. you're interested in kind of going and seeing the digital version at Longlead. And, you know, and I found it because another writer brought it to me and said, you should check this one out.
And one other point I want to make about that story, you kind of alluded to it, is that she was not, for lack of a better term, feminist in the way that she approached her job in any way, or even in some of the protests that went on within her company, Time Life. There was a lot of sexism, as there was everywhere. She pretty much just ignored it, and she operated like a man, and the writer, a man of that time, I should say. And the writer makes the point. She makes the point that she can't really decide if that's right or wrong, because if Virginia Kraft had operated any other way, she may have never gotten to the place she got.
Right. And you know, one thing that I've certainly learned working in sports media is that people who seem to agitate too much don't go, they irritate their bosses and they get forced out. And, you know, even if what they are talking about and what they're advocating for is the right and just position, whatever that might be, but you operate within a system. And that is certainly something that still is in effect today. And that I think, you know, women in the business and people who are not, you know, who would not have been in the business 50 years ago, who are now in the business, that's a measure that they have to take, is how, you know, how much, because it's many people can ignore a lot of the things that happen in sports from an equity standpoint, because they'll never be affected by them. But the people who are affected by them have to really figure out how much they're going to agitate around those issues. And, you know, perhaps the key to her success was that she just said no on the agitating. And so anyway, it's a fascinating story. I'm really glad you brought that one up.
Well, as you can see, there are endless topics and discussions we can have about not only women's sports, but this great collection that Jane edited. Again, it's called The Year's Best Sports Writing 2024. Jane McManus, so thank you so much for being with us.
Great conversation. Thank you so much, Eric.
For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.